ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What if the most ordinary things in your life aren't ordinary at all? A toothbrush, the pockets in your jeans, even a gravestone. Someone designed them, shaped them, argued over them, and got it so right, you've stopped noticing. The everyday is full of hidden ingenuity, and on By Design with me, Anthony Burke, we pull it all into the light. Search for By Design on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's the biggest expense for the Australian government? What does it shell out the most on, according to the budget handed down a few weeks back? After grants to states, it's the age pension and the National Disability Insurance Scheme, the NDIS. The government's so worried about the growing cost of the NDIS, it's unveiled a suite of measures to slow it. But bigger than the NDIS, more expensive and set to grow about as fast, is a handout not listed in the budget's expenses table. It's the so-called tax expenditure on superannuation. That's right, almost as big as payments to age pensioners and bigger than the payouts for the NDIS are the tax benefits delivered to users of superannuation, the bulk of whom earn above average incomes. They cost the government about as much to deliver as they would if it paid the cash directly into bank accounts. But because it delivers them through the tax system into super accounts, most of us, most of the time, don't see them. The really good thing about tax expenditures, from the point of view of those who get them, is that they're near invisible. Until this latest budget, when the Treasurer ripped away the cloak covering the tax concession for capital gains. What's next? Welcome to The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and our guest this week, Kerry Sadiq, who's Professor of Taxation at the Queensland University of Technology and has been tracking the twists and turns in the way we've treated tax expenditures over the past six decades, and Richard Dennis, who's Chief Executive of the Australia Institute and who, like me, is obsessed with things that are invisible and really wants them to be seen. Welcome, Kerry, and welcome, Richard.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Peter. Delighted to be here.
Richard, can I ask you first, off the top of your head, what's your least favourite tax expenditure, the least defensible? We've already mentioned superannuation, so I've bagged that one. What's the one you most dislike?
Well, super's the one I most dislike, obviously. It's enormous and unfair. But the one that just sort of sticks out as what the hell is the fact that we tax jet fuel cheaper than we tax the petrol that people drive their cars around in. So
why on earth would we do that?
Well, obviously, as a society, we came together and through our parliament thought, you know what, if we had to help anyone with their transport needs, it should be people who fly a lot. Now, I don't know what the real answer is, but thanks to the data we get in the budget, in the budget papers, the tax expenditure statements, we can see this. And because we can see this, we can go and ask the people we vote for, what did you do that for? You know, and there's going to be a big debate about when we should increase fuel excise for passenger vehicles. The government gave us a temporary respite recently for 3 months, end of June. That's likely to come back up, but what's with the cheap jet fuel? And no one's ever had to explain it. That's why tax expenditures are so powerful.
Kerry, tax expenditures used to be completely invisible. Indeed, the name didn't exist until the 1960s. What happened? How was the concept made visible in the US and in Australia?
Well, the concept actually came from a guy called Stanley Suri, and he served as Assistant Secretary for Tax Policy in the United States. And he first coined the term in 1967, so nearly 60 years ago. And what he was referring to is tax concessions offered by government that he believed should be looked at just like their direct spending programs.
Because they're the same. When did we pick up on that in Australia and how?
We actually picked up on it quite early, back in 1972, 1973, with Prime Minister Gough Whitlam, who actually asked for H.C. Coombs, the former Reserve Bank of Australia governor, to have a look at the spending of the previous government. But what Coombs did is look at 48 disguised tax expenditures. And that actually broke new ground in Australia, because that report provided comprehensive information outlining the nature of the expenditures, the cost, the date of introduction, the commitment, purpose, operation. And then it sort of made various comments around what we should be doing about these tax expenditures. So, for example, Coombs, way back in 1973, said that we should be limiting their terms, not making them last forever.
I think it was a limit of 3 years.
Yes, yes, way back in 1973.
So part of that would be working out the reason for the tax expenditure, spelling it out, at least for the record. Peter Costello, the Coalition Treasurer, received, I suppose, a wake-up call on this in 1993. The Howard Costello government had set up a commission of audit. They often do this when a new government comes in to look at previous policies, just as the Whitlam government had done. It also recommended action on tax expenditures. What did the commission of audit recommend?
It recommended regular reporting, mandatory reporting. That's now known as the Tax Expenditures and Insight Statement. It's normally released around December, January each year when we're on Christmas holidays and not taking much notice of the documents that the government releases. My biggest complaint is what it doesn't require is that ongoing evaluation. I'm absolutely all for transparency, just like you and Richard. But transparency for the sake of transparency does absolutely nothing. We need to action that transparency.
Why do you think we are not evaluating, Richard? We're reporting, at least the Treasury is reporting now, the 300 biggest ones, but most of the time that seems to be it.
Look, great question. And, you know, my answer, having kind of been around these issues for nearly 30 years now, is that in Canberra, you know, populists ask for cash and the serious players ask for tax expenditures, because they know that once you sneak them in, no one notices. They know they avoid the annual appropriations type processes, and they know they're a bit complicated. And, you know, that complexity combined with the sort of lack of visibility makes keeping them a lot handier. Like, everyone knows that we have duty-free tobacco and duty-free alcohol at the airport, but try finding someone in government, and I don't mean a minister, I mean a senior public servant in any of the relevant departments, to give you the policy rationale for duty-free, and you will not get further than, yeah, it's been there a long time. But let me give you another kind of related example. The government's just come out and said, hey, look, everybody, you know, just we'll help you out at tax time. And I don't mind this, by the way. I just explain that this is, you know, where people don't see into the complexity. The government said, look, if you just want to claim up to $1,000, that's fine. Just, you know, you don't need any receipts. Just ask for $1,000.
Instant tax deduction.
Yeah, good. Oh, tick, tick, tick. Simplicity, good. You know, popular, good. But that means that someone on the top tax bracket gets $485 for not asking. Someone on the 30% tax bracket gets $300 for not asking. And low-income earners might get $0 or $200. So,
and that's not at all visible.
No.
Until you mentioned it, I hadn't realised that. The audit office has examined tax expenditures, Kerry. It's examined them twice. What is it recommended?
Yeah, you're right, Peter. The audit office has looked at it twice, and each time they've suggested better integration of tax expenditures into the budget process and a systematic review to ensure that tax expenditures continue to meet their intended objectives.
Hang on, their intended objectives. So they've recommended that we actually work out what the objectives for tax expenditures are.
Well, that's the irony, and that's what Richard has been talking about. We often don't even know what the objectives of these expenditures are, or in fact, if we outlined them, we'd find out that the objectives perhaps are not palatable.
Has the government acted on either of those recommendations, repeated recommendations, a year apart?
I don't want to be overly critical because we do have our tax expenditures and insights statement.
Every January, every Christmas holidays.
It's always a Christmas present for people who read it. And each year, the information has improved. So, for example, the last couple of years, we've seen demographic data, which is fantastic because for researchers like me, what that demographic data shows is that it's high-income earning men who get the most benefits. But essentially, we are well behind a lot of other developed countries, particularly our OECD member countries. We just don't report and manage the same way that other countries do.
Do other countries treat them as expenditures and review them as expenditures?
Yes, some countries do. They actually treat them as being the equivalent of direct expenditures and assess them on that basis. And they also have what we call sunset clauses.
I'm wondering, though, Richard, whether what's just happened in the budget has sort of changed that. Even though the Expenditure Review Committee doesn't need to look at tax expenditures, doesn't need to look at them, it just has.
Absolutely.
And maybe this means that things will get more serious. Maybe this means they'll be subjected to more scrutiny from here on.
Look, I hope so. And, you know, I think what the government's done in terms of the announced reforms to capital gains tax and negative gearing and trusts, I think that's both good policy and it's good process in that it has come from these tax expenditure statements. And, you know, at the Australia Institute, we used to calculate for ourselves what we thought the percentage of capital gains tax discount going to the top 10% of income earners were, or the percentage of benefits from trusts going to different groups. And we could use census and other data to do that, but it's so much better that Treasury now does it itself. And now that they do it, it's so stonkingly obvious to anyone that even flicks through it.
The top 10% get half of the benefits of the capital gains tax discount.
Exactly.
Almost all of the benefits of franking credits.
That's right. And the vast majority of superannuation benefits, and I'm going to guess most of the benefits of the subsidised jet fuel as well. So these kind of distributional analyses that Treasury is now doing, I think, are really important. And I don't think it's a coincidence that early in his treasurership, Jim Chalmers kind of got Treasury to start publishing that data. And then a year or two later, it's like, look at this problem. I think we should fix it. The next step is to get people to really understand that giving people a free lunch is the same thing as paying for their lunch. You'll often hear conservative politicians say, oh, don't worry about tax expenditures. It's just, you know, giving people the tax that they were going to pay back. It doesn't really count. But imagine if I owned a restaurant and I got to give, you know, free lunches to my wealthy friends while charging everybody else full freight for their lunch. Is it a benefit to get a free lunch from someone? You bet. And when it's the government, when it's our elected representatives handing out those free lunches, the parliament and the public should really scrutinise not just who's getting them, but, yeah, why? Why is anyone getting these free lunches?
Kerry, you must feel at times, probably like Richard, as if you're sort of speaking a different language. One of the things we often hear is that government spending costs us money, a tax cut saves us money. Might they be right that they're in fact not the same thing?
Absolutely not. They are exactly the same thing economically. There is no doubt, and I think Richard has described it beautifully with his free lunch example. How can you possibly see any difference? The difference lies in the politics and the perception. So politicians can sell these tax expenditures really easily when they bring them in, and we can see how difficult it is for politicians to sell their removal.
Can I do this quick quiz? And it's the quiz I like to do on this topic because some people say they know what's a tax cut and they know what's spending, and the two are different, they say. I want you listening now to answer me this, and then we'll ask, I guess, whether they know the answer. What is Australia's private health insurance rebate? It costs the government $7 billion per year, but is that $7 billion spending, costing the government money, or is it a tax expenditure costing the government revenue? Your time starts now. Do you even know the answer, Kerry? Do you even know the answer, Richard?
I think they changed it.
That's right. It was one.
It did.
And then it got changed to the other. But the measure itself
didn't change.
Was broadly the same. Mm-hmm. So tax expenditures, in some sense, are expenditures, and we're going to turn our attention to the biggest of them. And a warning, you might be affronted. Some of the biggest are in our backyards. We're exploring what tax expenditures are, what the big ones are, here on The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National, with me, Peter Martin, this week joined by expenditure sleuths Kerry Sadiq from the Queensland University of Technology and Richard Dennis from the Australia Institute. Richard, when we mention the big one, the biggest tax expenditure at the top of the list prepared by Treasury, some of us are going to get defensive. They'll argue that if tax expenditures are deviations from normal, our biggest one isn't a deviation from normal at all. It's a question of what is normal. That expenditure, by the way, are tax-free gains on the family home. Do baselines, benchmarks, they're called, decisions about what's normal, really matter when you're defining a tax expenditure? In fact, is it like the second front in the war over whether a tax break is a tax break or not?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So, yes, is the default setting that we pay tax when someone puts money in our pocket? If yes, then saying you don't have to pay any tax when you make capital gain selling your house is by definition a tax expenditure. Now, people recoil at that and say, oh, that's terrible, houses are special. Well, that's the thing about Parliament. We're allowed to treat houses as special. We are. That's the point. That's why no one pays tax, and it's why people that literally own $40 million mansions and then sell them for $50 million go, oh, but the $10 million capital gain I made is obviously tax-free. So, yeah, we're allowed to treat the capital gain on houses as tax-free if we want to, and clearly in Australia we seem to want to do that. But the tax expenditure statement forces us to keep track of the cost of that decision, as it should.
Is this an issue around the world, Kerry? Indeed, you can't really compare tax expenditures, I suppose, because what's normal in one country is different in another.
The tax expenditures themselves can be different, but because the OECD does a lot of work around tax expenditures and the IMF does work and there are labs that research this, there does tend to be a fairly standard benchmark that we use. And it's academic and technical, so I won't bore everyone with it.
You're part of that process.
I am. So in essence, Peter, we do have a benchmark. Now, there are variations built into that. We see that in Australia. We see it in other jurisdictions. But I think people know what a tax concession or a tax expenditure looks like. They know when someone's getting a benefit that they're not.
Let's look at the big one. That one I mentioned, should we scrap it? Should we scrap the fringe benefits tax exemption for the family home, or at least scrap it for those really expensive homes you were talking about, Richard?
Yes, I think we should absolutely cap the capital gains tax exemption for the so-called family home because, to be crystal clear, there are family homes that are costing tens of millions of dollars. And the tax system, combined with the way that banks like to structure loans, gives very wealthy people really strong incentives to buy absolutely the most expensive house they can get their hands on and then load it up with the cheapest debt you can get, which is a debt secured against your so-called family home. So as income inequality gets worse in Australia, as those at the top gobble up a larger and larger share of our income, it's inevitable that the price of trophy homes is going to rise a lot faster than the price of two-bedroom apartments 40 minutes from the city.
You're suggesting that high-income people don't have homes with many, many, many bedrooms and double tennis courts only because they like those things.
Well, it's fascinating, isn't it? Everyone wants to talk about housing supply. Everyone wants to talk about high density. All these things. It's like, all right, what if there was no big tax benefit to having a harbourfront block of land with a tennis court, enormous swimming pool, a bungalow, blah, blah, blah. Now, to be clear, if someone wants to blow that much money on that, I'm not going to tell them not to, but we've got a tax system that says you'd be mad to not park tens of millions of dollars in a harbourfront house if you can afford to, because as I said, these trophy homes are finite in number. So as the income inequality gets worse, as the wealth of billionaires rises faster than the wealth of people working in aged care, it's inevitable that the price of those trophy homes is going to rise faster than average.
So how would you wind it back?
Oh, just pick a number, you know, pick a number that doesn't scare too many people. And
20
say,
million, 10 million?
Oh, gee, you're a bit conservative. I still think $1 million is a lot of money. But yeah, let's pick 5 or 10. But again, let's be clear. And this is
your
important.
Capital gain above that would be taxed, but not below that.
Correct. And you know, I'm an economist. I've taught economics. I've got all the qualifications. It's okay for me to say this. A lot of policy and politics is making up numbers. All right, so there's no right number, 5 million, 7.2, maybe 8.3 or 10, right? These are made up numbers. But if the made up number aligns with some sense of the distribution of the price of houses and it aligns with some sense of people's perception of fair enough, then those made up numbers become quite important.
What would be on your list, Kerry?
I would focus on some of the ones with numbers, capital gains tax, our superannuation system, but I'd also be looking at, you know, jet fuel, some of the ones that Richard has talked about. We need to look at these expenditures and say, are they harming or are they doing our country good?
What about the goods and services tax, Richard? We have exemptions there. We exempt private school fees. We also exempt fresh food.
Yeah, and private school fees, private health insurance, financial services and fresh food. You know, back when the GST was getting negotiated, of course, Peter Costello and John Howard really, really wanted it on fresh, well, they wanted it on all food. The Democrats were in balance of power. They used their casting vote in the Senate because Labor was opposed to the GST and said, well, how about we carve fresh food out? There was lots of meetings with whiteboards and the definition of fresh food got thrashed out with, you know, all sorts of products getting included or excluded. But to be clear, Peter Costello and John Howard always wanted private school fees to be excluded. And there was almost no conversation about that. Now, over time, the number of Australians going to private schools has increased a lot. The price of the most expensive private schools is rising, as you would expect, in line with growing income of our wealthiest Australians. So the cost of carving out private school fees is rising very quickly. But what people probably don't realise listening is if you take your kid for piano lessons, you pay GST on it. If you take your kid skiing, you pay GST on it. If you do any so-called extracurricular activities with your kid outside of school hours, you pay GST. But a lot of private schools have done a very good job of bundling up a whole bunch of what look like hobbies and what look like sports and including them in the educational curriculum, which, drumroll please, means there's no GST on the ski trip. There's no GST on the piano lessons.
Kerry, are you hopeful? I ask this because the Treasurer's just taken action on capital gains tax. He's been following the tax expenditures statement closely for years. He's upgraded it since taking office. Might this be the beginning of attacking other tax expenditures?
I am certainly hopeful, and clearly this most recent budget has tackled a lot of the really expensive tax expenditures and those hidden expenditures with that upside down effect where wealthy Australians are the beneficiaries rather than Australians on lower income brackets. Let's hope it translates into, you know, a solid foundation for actually looking at all of those 300 tax expenditures and not just the really expensive ones. Absolutely, we want to focus on the dollar amount. But as I said earlier, you know, let's go back and have a look at what they're trying to achieve and whether they align with what we want to look like as a country.
You're aware that people listening to you will say, aha, Kerry has identified the Jim Chalmers hit list and they just need to look at the document. There's a secret plan to remove all sorts of things, including the tax-free treatment of the family home.
Well, yeah, we will see what happens. Only time will tell.
Richard, Kerry, thank you. Before we go, as is traditional on this program, anything to look out for in the days and weeks ahead? Kerry.
I'm going to be interested to see the politics and the media framing around these tax expenditures that have been proposed in the budget.
It's already begun. I saw a headline saying billionaires oppose.
Yeah. So I think that's what we're going to look out for, is that narrative and the politics that come into play. Because as I said, tax expenditures, you know, economically, exactly the same as direct expenditures. The difference is in the politics and the perception.
Richard.
Well, I think the one to watch out for is June 30, because the government used a tax expenditure to make petrol cheaper for us when Donald Trump attacked Iran. And that was a temporary reduction in fuel excise. That's due to come off on June 30. But at the same time, the Prime Minister is going to have to tell us we can't afford to keep that temporary petrol tax excise in place. He's telling everyone that we can afford to keep giving away more than half the gas we export for free. And to tie a bow in this, when we give gas away for free, it doesn't show up in the budget papers. It doesn't even show up in the tax expenditure statements. But it's a very generous gift of our government to the gas export industry. So, yeah, it's a nice combination of political pressure. The government will be under pressure to keep petrol cheap, and they're under pressure to collect more revenue from gas. Watching them explain why motorists have to see their petrol price go up, but the gas industry gets to keep their cheap gas, that's going to be fun to watch.
Richard Dennis, budget watcher and tax watcher at the Australia Institute, and Kerry Sadiq, Professor of Taxation and Tax Expenditures Guru at the Queensland University of Technology. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
And thank you for listening. You can find our episodes on the ABC Listen app or live on ABC Radio National Thursdays. If you have any thoughts or questions or comments, no economic question is stupid, you can email us. Harold has done that by theeconomy.stupid@abc.net.au. Harold writes, quick thought on the capital gains tax changes. There's some pushback from people complaining that removing the discount is penalising them, which is understandable, given that they'll have to pay more tax going forward. I suggest, Harold says, an alternative approach to framing it. Imagine if instead we lived in a world where all income was taxed the same way, regardless of whether it came from wages or assets. Whether that should be the case is a topic for another day. Imagine the government then saying, OK, you asset holders only, we're going to introduce a capital gains tax discount and you won't have to pay as much tax, but you poor wage earners, you won't get the discount, you'll have to pay full tax. I think the community would be outraged. Harold writes, and that's exactly the point, as it happens, that Richard and Kerry have been making today. Daniel, who's no longer a smoker, has written in about last week's program on illegal tobacco. He writes, these outlets are everywhere. It's just insane. One point your program missed is about packaging. The illegal tobacco has very nice, attractive packaging. The legal tobacco has ugly, awful, plain packaging. Even if the price were the same between the two, I know which one I'd rather buy, just based on presentation. He also writes, I find it utterly shocking and baffling that governments have just let this happen. I've lived in virtual mafia states before corruption gets going, and I know what it's like. Thank you, Daniel. The address, theeconomy.stupid@abc.net.au. Thanks to producer Sam Carmody. I'm Peter Martin. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.